gentlemen, to the Minnesota Progressive Repartee for your Wednesday afternoon. Brett Johnson on today's show on a beautiful Wednesday afternoon. In fact, it's so nice, I've pre-recorded today's show, so I'm out there enjoying the weather. Well, I sort of am. I actually have a commitment to another event, so that's why today's show is pre-recorded. But I do have three great interviews lined up for you coming up on today's program. Coming up, we'll be speaking with Professor David Schultz of Hamline University, talking about the DFL really making a big push towards marijuana legalization. We'll be talking about why they're doing this and drawing some interesting correlations between how the marriage amendment actually helped the Democrats in 2012 and how that might actually be a somewhat similar situation as to what we're seeing now with the Democrats pushing for marijuana legalization in Minnesota. Also ahead, we'll be speaking with Nancy Nord-Bentz of Protect Minnesota, talking about the unfortunate state fair shooting we had on Monday, as well as some of the great work Protect Minnesota is doing in terms of trying to get gun safety and gun reform in the state. But first, a conversation with Gail Shore of Cultural Jambalaya. Now, you may have been hearing these ads airing on AM 950 talking about Cultural Jambalaya's Diversity Awards, which are a really cool thing. These are taking place on Thursday, October 3rd at the Metropolitan Ballroom in Golden Valley, where they're going to be honoring students and educators that are working to make Minnesota a better place. A really neat event coming up. Now, unfortunately, the tickets are sold out, but you can still go and follow along what's happening with Cultural Jambalaya on their social media accounts and on their website. But now let's bring in Gail Shore of Cultural Jambalaya. Hey, Gail, how you doing today?
Thanks. Good morning, Brett.
Yeah, and this sounds like a really cool event that's highlighting students and educators who are, well, just making a difference and making the world a better place, which is certainly a good thing to have in today's political environment, which we don't necessarily need to get into. But this is a really cool event coming up. And can you tell us more about it and what you expect to have happen?
Well, I sure can. And first of all, I should probably tell you a little bit about Cultural Jambalaya. We're a Minnesota nonprofit that uses global photography in the classroom to broaden worldviews of students. And we create free educational resources that include the production of a video series that features images and narratives from across the globe that teachers use to break down cultural barriers by promoting understanding and respect for all people. So Cultural Jambalaya obviously believes that photography can be a creative teaching tool in the classroom because it's just a wonderful way to illustrate our diverse cultural backgrounds. I mean, we want to shatter stereotypes, and our videos ask students to examine each other's similarities as well as our differences, because obviously the more we know about each other's backgrounds and history and religion, the more respectful we can become of one another. And so at our annual event each year, we honor other people in the community that are doing wonderful things. And so we have our annual Diversity Awards. And this year we're going to be recognizing four amazing champions that that demonstrate the collective understanding of the cultures and ethnicities and races that make Minnesota a dynamic and prosperous and tolerant place. So these champions that I like to call them, because they're just doing extraordinary work, we're honoring them because they've made a real positive difference by advancing multiculturalism and ethnic diversity in their local communities.
Yeah, and the Cultural Jambalaya Diversity Awards again take place Thursday, October 3rd, 5:30 at the Metropolitan Ballroom in Golden Valley. So how were these winners selected? Were you getting submissions from around the state of Minnesota? And what kind of criteria did you decide to use to in terms of who gets recognized?
Exactly. We earlier in the year, and then I should also say that the next year's event, those nomination forms will be online probably sometime in January or February for next year's awards. But we reach out to people all over the state, educators and nonprofits and businesses and anybody that may know of someone who, as I said, makes a real difference in lives with multiculturalism and ethnic diversity. Those are that's the key point of the nominations. And so this year, we have four winners. If we have time, I'd love to tell you a little bit about each of them.
Oh, yeah, I've looked through some of these. Yeah, I'm really fascinated, especially by the Stillwater podcast team, and then there's some other really kind of cool things that students and educators have done. Yeah, so tell us about those.
Well, starting with the Stillwater Area High School's podcast team. And this is a collaboration with Family Means Cimarron Teen Program and Story Arc. And this is a group of first-generation immigrant students that have created an original narrative podcast. And the students have written the script, acted the roles, recorded and edited original episodes that discuss really important topical issues that range from immigration to deportation and discrimination. So this is a real creative group of students, and they're from Stillwater Area High School.
And if I can interrupt you for 1 second, that is such a cool idea as well, because we are such a storytelling society. That's really how humans function, and to actually put on fictional ways of depicting realistic event, that seems like a really effective way to change people's minds and to get them to really think about these types of issues in a different way when you can do that through radio drama, which I also take,
exactly,
by the way.
And these are the kinds of issues that these students bring to school every day. Issues that personal issues, family issues, community issues, and it gives them an opportunity to discuss them through this podcast. So it really is creative.
Absolutely.
And then speaking of storytelling, another one of our winners is the Coalition of Asian American Leaders, and they have a very wonderful initiative that's another unique storytelling program that brings together multi-ethnic groups that portray the diversity and multiculturalism of people of Asian Pacific descent living here in Minnesota, and it gives them a chance to tell some amazing stories of their lives. So that's another one. And then we have a group of teachers from South St. Paul Secondary School, and they have a group called the Affinity Groups, and these teachers promote really important conversations around the school's increasingly diverse student population. So they took their students' experiences of being marginalized and repurposed them into a source of energy for positive change. It gives these students a safe place to talk about a lot of the issues that are affecting their lives. And this was all brought upon by the teachers. So that's the third award winner. And then the fourth is a woman from Rochester. Her name is Chow Motella, and she's a multicultural academic advisor at the Rochester Community and Technical College. And Chow has brought diversity and inclusion programming and other important initiatives to the RCTC campus in order to build an equitable and inclusive environment for all of her students. She's just a real role model and rock star down there. So these are the four winners that we're going to honor at our event, our sold-out event, I might add, on Thursday, October 3rd. We're going to have it at the Metropolitan Ballroom in Golden Valley. It's presented by Cerisi Conlin, the law firm. And T. Michael Rambo is going to sing at our event, and it's going to be fabulous. And it's just a wonderful way for us to honor people in the community that are really doing good work.
And as you said, the event currently is sold out. So unfortunately, if you're listening out there, you won't be able to attend this year's event. But where else can people kind of follow along with what's happening with these diversity awards, through social media, websites, or other avenues?
Right. Well, our website is culturaljam.org. And you can go to the website. I've got photos there from, these are based on my photos from traveling around the world for over 40 years. And that was really sort of the impetus of the video series that we produced. And you can see photos. You can watch all of the videos for free. I particularly encourage teachers to go there. And you can learn about many areas around the world: Latin America, Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. And you can pull up any of these videos, and hopefully they will be of help to you in the classroom.
And as you said a little bit earlier in the interview, while of course this year's event is sold out, there are opportunities where if you're an educator or maybe just know someone in an educational environment who is making a difference, there is going to be a way to have them make submissions for next year's award ceremony. Tell us a little bit about that, what the process is like, because I imagine it's not super intimidating. If you know someone who's got a really cool thing going on that's making a difference, they definitely can submit something to be eligible for these awards.
No, it is not intimidating. We have a very simple nomination form that's very easy to fill out. and it'll be online. As I said, we'll probably have that up for next year in early 2020. And it's open to anybody who lives or works or goes to school in the state of Minnesota. So we're encouraging people outstate as well as those in the Twin Cities to think about people that they know in their lives who are doing great work and really, really making a difference through multiculturalism.
Yeah, especially in outstate areas. That would be very interesting to see some submissions come from there as well. So really looking forward to these events, and you can find more information. Give that website one more time, Gail.
It's culturaljam.org, and if anybody wants to call me, they're welcome to call me at 612-770-4106, or they could email me at info@culturaljam.org.
That's Gail Shore. She's the founder and executive director of Cultural Jambalaya. Again, Gail, thanks so much for joining us on the program today.
Thanks a lot, Brett.
And coming up next on the Minnesota Progressive Repartee, we'll be speaking with Hamline University professor David Schultz about why the DFL is making a big push for marijuana legalization. That's on the way next on the Minnesota Progressive Repartee. It's Brett on your Wednesday afternoon. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, Brett Johnson on the Minnesota Progressive Repartee. Right now, we're joined by Hamline University political science professor David Schultz talking about some local political news, including what's happened at the state fair over the past 10 days or so. Also talking about marijuana legalization in Minnesota and, well, whether personal lives of politicians still matters in today's political environment. So joining us now is Professor David Schultz. Hey, David, how are you doing today?
Today.
Excellent. Glad to have you on the program. So let's start off with this article you wrote in your blog, Schultz's Take, which people can find over on the internet if you just Google Schultz's Take. And I want to talk about what you wrote about the DFL really emphasizing marijuana legalization, because I've kind of picked up on this too over the past few months that they really seem to be making a big push for this. And you go through in your blog post citing some polling data and how well marijuana legalization parties did in 2020. But what's interesting when you bring up some of this polling data is that while the marijuana legalization parties did really well in the urban cores of Minneapolis and St. Paul, the support was still there in the suburbs, but not quite as big as it was in the urban areas. So do you think there is a strong correlation between some of the electoral success that these parties had in 2018 and possible success for the DFL if they make it a tentpiece part of their campaign in 20?
Perhaps. And again, let's put some numbers together here. Is that in 2018, there were two pro-legalization recreational parties, recreational use of marijuana parties that ran candidates for office. They made sure at the statewide office they didn't compete against one another. So the two parties both got at least 5% of the vote, qualifying as major parties. And so one of the things that sort of I thought was interesting was the question of, well, the Democrats have announced now that they're going to be pushing very hard for legalization. Walz's administration has told the state agencies to prepare for it, and the Democrats are going on a statewide, listening tour, whatever we may call it, to try to push for recreational use of marijuana. And the question is, does this politically make sense? And I'm not going to reach a final conclusion whether it does or not, but some numbers I think help us think about this issue. First, according to some polling data, about, let's say, 60 to 65% perhaps of Minnesotans support legalization of marijuana. That's based upon some Gallup surveys and a Mason-Dixon. However, when we break it down, a couple of other things become interesting. One is that among that legalization, a much smaller percentage support it for recreational use, whereas many others support it for medicinal use, and recreational use or legalization of recreational use of marijuana doesn't seem to be a top priority for very many people. The reason why I bring all this together, I'm trying to figure out, well, what percentage of the population, voting population in Minnesota, does consider recreational use of marijuana, its legalization, to be a top priority. Roughly, I'm going to say it's about 5 to 6% of the vote based upon support for one of the pro-legalization parties. So now the question is, if only 5% support that as an issue. Why are the Democrats pushing it so hard? And I think this is where the Democrats have an interesting strategy. And whether it plays out, I don't know. Okay, remember back in 2012 when the Republicans put the marriage amendment on the ballot? Remember that?
Exactly. Yes, I do. And that ended up, if I remember correctly, flipping both the House and the Senate to DFL control.
Exactly, because it was 2012. Mitt Romney's running for president. The Republicans are thinking, okay, we'll put the marriage amendment on the ballot. It'll bring out our base. It'll make sure we keep control of the House and the Senate and flip the state to Mitt Romney in the presidential race. Well, it completely backfired, and it brought out incredible numbers of young people to vote. And it was an issue for young people at that point, we'd say under the age of 30, that brought them out to vote because they supported marriage equality. The result, Democrats took control of the House and the Senate. Dayton was governor, and marriage equality was written into law. So I'm thinking what the Democrats are perhaps thinking going into 2020 is that, well, listen, maybe legalization of marijuana is like the marriage amendment in the sense that we know that younger people under the age of 30 overwhelmingly support this as an issue. Possibly the core group of people who consider it a number one priority, again, are young people. They're hard to turn out to vote oftentimes. If we now push this as an issue, can we mobilize young people to come out and vote, which would then help tremendously in terms of keeping the state in the Democratic column in the presidential race and helping other statewide candidates? So I think that's the core strategy that's there. Now, whether that works is a good question, because it could also bring out significantly the social conservatives to vote against it. Also, the data that I put together suggested that the support of it, that is legalization of marijuana for recreational use, is mostly Minneapolis, St. Paul, the urban cores. Will it produce help in terms of electing a Democratic Senate across the state? Not so clear on that. Will it perhaps create a backlash among suburban women who might not support it? Not clear on that. So it's an interesting strategy aimed at mobilizing young voters. But again, I don't know whether it's a strategy that will play like 2012 in the sense that it mobilizes young people, or the other lesson of 2012, put something like this out as a big issue and it produces the opposite result. I think that's a really interesting question.
Yeah, the other important part, too, is whether this is actually the top voting issue for a number of people. Obviously, the 5 or 6% who voted for those marijuana legalizations, perhaps that might be true. But even as you go back to 2012, that took quite a campaign to actually defeat the marriage amendment. That really was the number one issue for the DFL going back to 2012 when they launched just a massive campaign. We saw all of those orange signs. I don't remember the exact wording on there, but this was a large campaign that they launched in 2012, and it would be tough to duplicate that for an issue like marijuana legalization, which might not elicit the same sort of reactions that we saw in 12 with the possible banning of gay marriage through the Constitution.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think the gay marriage issue, or the banning on gay marriage, same-sex marriage, I think was actually orchestrated really well to try to oppose it. The political momentum was in the right direction, and it struck many people. An effort by the state to regulate whom you can marry is something fundamentally wrong. I remember speaking up in the Brainerd area during the debates on that amendment, and I was at some community meeting, and there was an older woman who stood up and identified herself, and she said, "I'm a Republican. I'm a lifelong Republican." And then she said, and I'm going to clean up her language. She said, "No, GD government is going to tell me who I can marry or not marry." And that's when I turned to somebody and said, the marriage amendment is going to die, because it struck people, even hardcore Republicans many times, that the government doesn't tell us who to marry. Now, maybe marijuana is like that, but I'm not sure it is. And when I've also given talks in the last year out in suburbs and have talked about recreational use of marijuana, what I hear suburban women talk about. And remember, suburban women are the most important voter in Minnesota, if not in the country. It was suburban women who basically elected Democrats to take back the U.S. House and the Minnesota House. When I give these talks about legalization of marijuana, suburban women sort of raise their eyebrows and say to me, great, another thing I got to protect my kids from. And so I worry that pushing the marijuana issue too hard might alienate some of these suburban women who might say, and then on top of it, if there's an effort to try to reach out to greater Minnesota in the way Tim Walz successfully did, it may not be in terms of talking about marijuana, maybe talking about what? Healthcare, jobs, the economy, you know, the real bread and butter issues. And so I understand why the Democrats are talking about this issue, marijuana, to mobilize young people, to prevent more young people from voting for the pro-marijuana parties, but I think it comes with a risk in terms of a strategy.
And if I'm thinking about this, maybe from the DFL's perspective, they're not going to push it quite as hard as the marriage amendment. They perhaps could be doing exactly as you say, trying to peel off some of those people who voted for those legalized marijuana third parties and just hoping that they can get enough of those in the suburbs to maybe flip some of those GOP Senate seats. That's maybe what it's just coming down to, is just trying to win a few of those Senate seats by making sure people don't vote for legalized marijuana now parties.
Well, I think you're right. And I think what the message for the Democrats has to be to those individuals who supported the legalization parties is to say, listen, if you vote for those candidates for legalization, they're not going to win. They're not going to win seats in the legislature come 2020. And guess what? If we don't, as a party, the Democrats take back the Senate and hold the House, it's never going to happen. So if you want legalization of marijuana for recreational use, you're going to have to vote DFL to be able to do that. And so I think that's the message, exactly as you described it here. Peel them off or peel them back or pull them back, whatever the word I'm looking for, or bring them into the Democratic Party with the hope that this will help the Democrats and will help those who support the legalization of marijuana.
Have we seen any movement from these legalized now marijuana parties? And I forgot the name of the other party as well, that they're going to be running local candidates in the state Senate or even in the state's House. And maybe this is playing a role possibly as well as to why the DFL is highlighting this, as well as saying, well, if they're going to be running in some of these local races, they could potentially turn what would be DFL wins into seats that stay with the GOP, especially on the state Senate side. Have we heard any rumblings on whether we're going to see these third-party pro-marijuana legalization candidates run in local Senate and House districts?
I haven't seen anything yet. And if we think about where those candidates might make a difference, I doubt it's going to be in Minneapolis and St. Paul, the urban cores. Those are overwhelmingly DFL districts. Okay, are they going to make much of a difference in, let's say, really hardcore Republican areas? No. But where they might make a difference in a few of those swing Republican or maybe a few swing House or Senate seats that currently Democrats hold or Republicans hold. And you're right, we're looking at a very, very small number of seats, probably in the Senate. We're looking at no more than probably a half a dozen seats that are going to control the fate of that body. And that's where I think the Democrats are worried. A candidate who gets maybe 5% of the vote in a very tight swing suburban district might be enough to throw the race, you know, to a Republican. And so that I think is the strategy at this point for the Democrats, is to prevent the defections to these parties. And so in some sense, it's trying to unofficially build a coalition, you know, with the pro-legalization parties by bringing their voters into the Democratic Party.
Yeah, exactly. Now that I think about it more, I believe if we go back to the attorney general race, I believe that third party legalized marijuana now candidate actually ended up saying, don't vote for me, vote for Keith Ellison, so that race doesn't flip to the GOP. And maybe they're thinking the same thing. Well, if that happened in the attorney general race, perhaps we can get that to happen around other offices as well that are up for election.
Correct.
Let's move on to another issue you wrote about, Professor Schultz, and that is what's been happening with Ilhan Omar. Of course, last week we saw allegations surface that she is having an extramarital affair with someone who is involved with their campaign finance team, and you wrote a post that talks about this idea that whether the public has the right to know about a politician's personal behavior. And one of the arguments that you brought up, not necessarily the one you're making, is that, well, that the public has a right to know and judge because personal behavior basically tells us something about public performance. The question I have for you, though, is this still relevant in today's political culture? Because I feel like there's so much tribalism now where people largely almost give this a pass unless it's something really atrocious and really out there that people say, well, if they still vote the way I want them to vote once they get into the office, well, I can let some of that personal baggage pass. What do you think about that?
I think it's an exceedingly good observation because, you know, I started with the argument of saying that in general, what other people do with their private lives is none of our business. And the same thing ought to be true with elected officials as a rule. However, increasingly there's evidence, you know, that because people don't always have all the information they need to make good policy choices themselves, they say, as long as I can trust a candidate's character, they seem like they're a decent person, I can have a beer or a cup of coffee with them, that's okay. Character matters, judgment matters. But you're right. What we're now starting to see is the polarization and the tribalism is so great that we're sort of taking an all or nothing approach. And what I mean by that, for Republicans, no matter what Donald Trump does in his private life or what he says, he's okay with them. For Democrats, no matter what candidates seem to do who are Democrats, whatever they've done in their private life, that's okay. You know, and this is where somebody like Al Franken really sort of tests everything, because what the Me Too movement did is to say that regardless of what a candidate may do in terms of public persona, that their private life, their private character can oftentimes bleed over into their public performance, and therefore we should not support people like Al Franken, you know, with the type of allegations about his behavior. The Me Too movement and Al Franken really has demonstrated a fissure, a question about that tribalism, because you're right. I think the tribalism is there, but the animosity, the acrimony, the disagreement over whether or not Al Franken should have stepped down with Senator Gillibrand right in pushing for that has really touched, I think, a raw nerve among many Democrats regarding how do we view the personal lives of public figures such as senators or U.S. House members.
And I think even going back to that Al Franken resignation back in 2017, I think a large reason why he ended up resigning and getting pressure from Democrats was not so much what he did. They were looking at that Alabama Senate race with Roy Moore and Doug Jones saying, well, if we have Al Franken still in the Senate by that time that election holds, well, we have no chance to actually win in Alabama. So I think that certainly played a large role as well, even though we're getting a little off into another topic there. But I think that's kind of why Franken ended up resigning in 2017, at least in my opinion. I think that had much more to do with that Alabama Senate race.
Well, I think you're right. I think what you're really hitting at here is exactly the point that I'm trying to make here, is where do we make the trade-offs? At what point are we willing to say we're okay to live with somebody's personal limitations versus the fact that keeping that person in office politically makes sense, or is that person politically expendable? And I think Al Franken became that perfect example here of where lots of issues came to play. Issues about how do we judge public characters, because we don't really have courts of law to do that, because I know many people complained and said he had no due process. Are we willing to give somebody a pass? What if a person admits that they've done something wrong? Do we have to sacrifice somebody for some other gain? Again, Al Franken really, really focused us on really all the different tensions surrounding how this plays out. And I would be a fool myself if I claimed and said that there's a simple answer that tells us when it's okay to give somebody a pass in their personal life. As far as I know, nobody who's listening to the show or two of us are angels. We all have made mistakes. We all slip on the ethical banana peels. The question is, at what point have we made so many mistakes in our personal life that it does speak to our public character or the ability of people to have confidence in us to be able to perform our duties. These are tough choices.
All right, Professor Schultz, one more topic I want to talk about, and that is, of course, the State Fair just wrapped up back on Monday, and I was reading through some of the pieces about some of the political parties and their actions at the State Fair, and I came across this Fox 9 piece where it was referencing both parties having to install security cameras at the State Fair for basic troublemakers that we're going through. We, of course, have the assault allegations that happened at the GOP booth, and as both the DFL and the Republican parties brought up at this year's State Fair, there were several ugly incidents of people berating and yelling at some of the campaign volunteers, people being spat on. Is this almost this is such a cynical way to look at it, but with installing these security cameras and trying to highlight some of these incidents, are both parties almost just looking for a way to show that the other side is very unhinged to score political points? Again, a very kind of cynical way to look at it, but
I think you make a good point. It sounds a little bit about security, but what it becomes better at this point is what? You now can put this up on YouTube or something like that and say, look at these people harassing us. Now, I mean, what I think this does, it's like a Cold War analogy. It just feeds into the partisanship, and it feeds into the broader sort of us versus them type of mentality. It's sad. I mean, it's sad to think about that. Yes, you know, we should be concerned legitimately about security issues. Remember, Ilhan Omar was apparently threatened, you know, with her life if she went to the State Fair. And so we probably have a larger discussion here about security at the State Fair, and we probably have some discussion here about security and civility at the political booths. I wish I could just sort of wave a magic wand and say, can't we just all act like adults and realize that, guess what, you know, that we should be able to disagree and not harass one another. But we seem to be at a point right now where that doesn't seem to be possible. So now let's get it on tape and make sure that we can use that just to fan the flames of partisanship even more.
And one more question for you regarding the State Fair, a little bit more of a lighthearted question, but is there any actual correlation between the number of State Fair appearances a candidate makes and actually winning races?
Not much. I was going to say, you probably have to show up to the State Fair at least once in Minnesota, but I doubt there's any good indication of that. In fact, if I just go back through my mind and just do a quick sort of, you know, thinking through here, probably no correlation whatsoever, but it would be interesting to see if candidates use the State Fair in different ways in terms of trying to enhance their campaign, because there are probably some techniques that work better than others. Good question, though.
Yeah, absolutely, because I'm thinking that from a politician's or a candidate's perspective, you're kind of there as a sitting duck, just basically to be yelled at all day. So I would think if I'm a candidate or a politician, I would probably want to somewhat limit my time there, unless you have really thick skin, because you are kind of out there to be confronted by people from all political stripes with the number of people that, of course, attend the State Fair.
Right. And also you have to think about the fact that over a 12-day period, how much of that time is actually useful in terms of campaigning there versus being other places too? I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. That's Professor David Schultz, a political science professor over at Hamline University. Hey, some good stuff we talked about today. We'll have to check in with you at a later time, Professor Schultz. Always good conversations that we have.
Anytime. Thank you for having me.
And coming up next on the Minnesota Progressive Repartee, we'll be speaking with Nancy Nord-Benz of Protect Minnesota, talking about some of the great work they've been doing at the State Fair and also around the state in general, around trying to get gun reform here in Minnesota. That's on the way next on the Repartee. It's Brett on your Wednesday afternoon. And we're back on the Minnesota Progressive Repartee for your Wednesday afternoon. Brett Johnson in studio. Again, our show today is pre-recorded, but do have some great interviews that we've been playing throughout the show, including this one right now with Nancy Nord-Benz. She is with Protect Minnesota, and she's talking about, unfortunately, some of the shootings we've seen recently, but then also on the good news front, some positive momentum we've made in terms of improving our gun safety here in this country and in the state of Minnesota. Hi, Nancy Nord-Benz. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for inviting me on.
Absolutely. Good to have you on our program today. So now let's start off with the unfortunate bad news that we've been happening so far. That's been happening so far. Of course, we had the shooting over the weekend in Odessa, Texas, and then we also had what was reported as a state fair shooting on Monday. Just react to those and tell us about what your initial thoughts are. I'm at least very concerned because under the current gun laws, I'm afraid we're going to see something a lot worse potentially take place at the state fair with how many people are there. I mean, shootings are never good, but I guess only three people getting shot, it could have been much, much worse.
Well, you're absolutely right. And, you know, before we jump to the state fair, I do want to point out that on Friday evening, a young man brought a gun to a high school football game in Mobile, Alabama, and shot nine people. So it's summer in America. And in summer in America, with our ridiculously lax gun laws, it happens to be the shooting season. And what we see is every single weekend, more and more of these terrible events that we would think would, you know, it used to be they happened maybe one a year. And now if you really look at the data on mass shootings, it's almost daily in the United States. Most of these don't get the kind of media that Odessa got or that El Paso got or that our state fair shooting yesterday got. But every single one of these shootings is destroying lives, and not just for the survivors who've lost a loved one, which is heartbreaking, but also for those who are shot. Many, many more people died in Odessa, or many less people died in Odessa than were shot and injured in Odessa, and those people are going to be living with the ramifications of being shot for the rest of their lives. And the same was true at the state fair. So we had three people shot at the state fair. The good news is it was right outside the gates. The bad news is it was right outside the gates at a time that was very busy. It caused all kinds of chaos. And you could say, oh, those people didn't die. But these were, it sounds like, relatively young men who for the rest of their life will be dealing with the results of having been shot. And so we have to kind of step away from the shock and awe of how many people died, and we have to look at the total numbers of Americans being shot, of which mass shootings account for about 2% of the victims. And we have to recognize that in households around this state and around this country, every single day, lives are being destroyed by gun violence. And it doesn't have to be this way, and you know that, and I know that, and anyone who can pick up a newspaper or watch the news knows that America is the only wealthy country that has this kind of a gun violence epidemic. You can't convince us that they don't have mentally ill people in Japan, and yet last year Japan had three gun deaths. And I want to just do a shout-out to our Governor Walz on that, because that was his quote this morning when he was talking about the shooting at the state fair, that we had three people shot in one night at the state fair, and he's going to Japan later in the week. 130 million people live there, and they had three gun deaths in the whole year last year. And so we've got to stop blaming video games. We've got to stop blaming single-parent homes. We've got to stop all the BS that's being thrown around about there, and we have to look at the actual truth, which is the countries and the states with the strongest gun laws have by far the lowest rates of gun deaths. And countries like America and states like, let's say, Louisiana, who have the highest gun deaths, also have the weakest gun laws. There's a direct or indirect relationship here. We need stronger laws in order to get this epidemic under control.
And of course, you at the state fair were working to change minds on some of these issues in terms of trying to bring gun safety to our state and gun reform. Talk a little bit about your experience at the state fair and whether you saw attitudes changing on gun reform compared to years past at the state fair.
Well, you know, it's interesting. My involvement at the state fair this year started with, we'd gotten a message that somebody had been carrying a gun at the state fair and that law enforcement at the state fair hadn't done anything about it. And so I ran over there and I had a long interview with the chief of police and with other law enforcement members from the state fair and got statements from their media. And we have to again make sure everybody understands that the official policy of the Minnesota State Fair is that guns are banned. That being said, surely we could do a lot more to make sure that people aren't carrying in anyway, because when I posted all this information on our social media platforms, I got all kinds of people with carry permits writing back kind of tauntingly saying, I carry every day I go to the state fair. Now, whether that's true or not, the reality is the shooting last night that was right outside the gates of the state fair is the closest we've come to imagining how horrible gun violence at the state fair would be. And I think every single poll right now of Minnesotans shows that Minnesotans support stronger gun laws. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But if we were to do a poll that asked, should we open the state fair to guns, it wouldn't be in the 90%. It would be close to 100% of Minnesotans would say absolutely not.
I wouldn't even want to go to the state fair either if they opened it up. That would make me very concerned.
They've had shootings in other state fairs where they do allow it. And so, I mean, can you imagine the crowds of the state fair? All those happy people. I love the fact all the generations together. It's just so wonderful. But there's a lot of alcohol, and there's a lot of different kinds of people. It's the great Minnesota get-together. Imagine if we allowed guns to be carried in state fair property. So this shooting last night was a wake-up call. And I think it's really important for the sake of the state fair that we underscore the fact that guns are banned at the state fair and that this shooting was right outside the gates. That being said, if you had been at the state fair and happened to be outside the gate, it would have felt to you like you were involved in a shooting at the state fair. And Minnesotans don't want that. The nonpartisan House of Representatives did their usual state fair poll, and what they found out is of those polled at the state fair by the nonpartisan House of Representatives, 89.1% of poll respondents said that they support passing our criminal background check bill and that they support passing our red flag bill, those are our big two, and that they want stronger gun laws. 89.1%. So I'm sitting over here wondering, what is it the Minnesota Senate is waiting for? They've gotten repeated invitations from Governor Walz, God bless him, to have a special session to pass these two bills, and they are not responding. They're hearing, I hope, that 89% of the people at the state fair support these bills, and they're not responding. Every poll has shown that Minnesotans want to make it harder for dangerous people to access guns. And yet they're not responding. And so I have to wonder what it is going on in the minds of Minnesota Senate leadership. We are moving into a huge election year. They have all kinds of senators who are vulnerable on this issue. And they're choosing to put their head in the sand and block two bills that are supported by 90% of Minnesotans. And as the governor has said, he would sign those bills tomorrow if they passed.
Wow, and almost 90% support is certainly good news. At least when I was going through and taking that survey, I was thinking, oh, I'm sure we were going to have the survey come out in favor of stronger gun safety measures, but I was thinking maybe a 60-40 margin, but 90-10, that is certainly quite a margin. Quite a few people are in favor of that. And as you were out there and other people with Protect MN were interacting with fairgoers, were you feeling like there was a change in attitudes? Because I've kind of gotten this sense as well where people who were always saying, well, I'm pro-Second Amendment, no gun control whatsoever, their term's gun control. I feel like there's been a change of the attitude saying, well, I guess we probably should have criminal background checks and red flag laws. Are you getting that sense, too, that people are wanting to change their mind on this as well?
Very much so. And our message to anyone out there that in the past has felt like stronger laws aren't necessary but is now rethinking that because they're just so horrified by all the shootings, folks, we want to build a bridge to help you join our Responsible Gun Owners of Protect Minnesota caucus and get engaged. Governor Walz has given us the best example ever of someone who had an A-plus rating by the NRA, and now through life experience, through involvement with people whose lives were shattered by gun violence, is now coming out as the strongest champion in governor that we've ever had. And he is this amazing model of how we don't have to be stuck in old ideas that maybe worked decades ago, but do not work today. And so I just really want to say to gun owners out there, we spent 6 days at Minnesota Games Fair in Anoka, and that was amazing. We gave out over 3,000 free trigger locks, and we had a lot of conversations. And I cannot tell you how many people came to us and said, you know, I used to be against everything you stand for, and now I'm still a little worried about it, but we have got to do something about this. I can't tell you how many gun owners said to us, I get a background check every time I buy a gun. It's no big deal. Why would I want somebody else who wouldn't pass a background check to be able to buy a gun? I can't tell you how many people we talked to who have lost a loved one to suicide by gun. Did you know that every single day in Minnesota, at least one person takes their life with a gun? Every single day. And, of course, the rates of this gun suicide are much higher in communities where there are more guns, rural communities. And so we talk to these people, we give them these trigger locks, and we hear back, I so wish I'd had one of these years ago when my nephew used my brother's gun to kill himself. These kind of incidents coming so closely together are changing the way Minnesotans think about this issue. They're realizing, yes, we have to get back to having a balance between the right to bear arms and having that be well regulated. They're sort of remembering the beginning of the Second Amendment in addition to the end of the Second Amendment, because that's how our forefathers wrote it. And so we are getting many more people. We all wear our orange Minnesotans Against Getting Shot t-shirts at the state fair. And I can't tell you how many people stopped me and thanked me and asked me where they could get our shirts, because they care about this issue. So the tide is turning, and Protect Minnesota is doing everything in our power to make sure that we can push these life-saving measures through or vote out the people who are obstructing them.
Absolutely. This is Nancy Nordbench. She is with Protect Minnesota. One final question for you, Nancy. What can people do to get involved?
Well, that is such an easy question. Just text the word orange to 474747, and that way you can become a member of Protect Minnesota. You do not have to make a gift. You can also go to our website, www.protectmn.org, and join there. Either way, please get involved. We need to have as many of those Minnesota voices as we can informed and ready to go by the next legislative session, because 2020 is going to be the fight for our lives, and not our lives, but the lives of all those whom we could save by passing these bills. So text orange to 474747 and please get involved.
Absolutely. Some great information there. Nancy, thanks so much for joining us again on the program today.
Thanks for having me. Have a great day. It's gorgeous outside.
And that's all the time we have for today on the Minnesota Progressive Repartee. Coming up tomorrow, we're back with a live show. Love to have your phone calls at 952-946-6205. Plus, we are going to be giving away tickets on tomorrow's program to Seavers Fall Festival. So definitely looking forward to that. We'll talk to you on Thursday. I can't believe